Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
If you agree that there's a line between appreciating another culture and appropriating it, where does it lie? If it's okay to eat at a restaurant that serves food from a different culture, is it okay to try to duplicate those recipes at home? What about if you're the chef? Is it okay to build your professional reputation on traditional dishes you didn't grow up eating, or does that cross the line? And who has the right to draw that line anyway? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Solejo has thought a lot about these questions. Having worked in the restaurant industry in positions from dishwasher to server to executive chef, and having grown up wishing sometimes for the Pop-Tarts and chicken nuggets she saw on TV rather than the dishes that her Vietnamese grandmother cooked for her. Today, she is co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. The program explores the many ways that food, how we cook it, eat it, and think about it, can be political. Solejo joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Soleil, welcome to Think.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I want to start by explaining the name of your podcast. If I have this right, it was inspired by a news story, right? This school principal in Oregon said maybe teachers should consider different kinds of bread that their students might eat at home, not just white sandwich bread. And somehow that made people go crazy.
Yeah. So it's really convoluted. But the simplest way to explain this is that she wanted teachers to use more culturally appropriate examples in their work. So, for example, if you were talking about a math problem and you were using sandwiches as the thing in the word problem, maybe not all of your students will know what a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is. And so her challenge was for teachers to look at the demographics of their classes and consider, okay, how do I explain this in terms that they will understand and recognize? And so the conservative news media got a hold of that and basically made it out to sound like she was calling peanut butter and jelly sandwiches racist.
It just doesn't seem like, it doesn't even seem like a stretch to ask a teacher to do that.
You would think.
So it is an example of just how important food is to us culturally. We use it as a stand-in for a lot more than just nutrition.
Yes. It is, everyone has to eat, more or less. And it is something that we used as just establish understanding, establish culture, and establish relationships. So it has so much meaning between people.
And the act of eating in public also has a status component to it. Where we eat, the kinds of things we eat, they telegraph something about where we come from and how much money we have.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, food now is such an integral part of pop culture. And, you know, there's so much that goes into it, from Instagram conspicuous consumption to who profits off of it to celebrities almost in the restaurant world that we worship or denigrate.
It is strange that we have so many celebrity chefs, but they seem to resemble one another.
What are you saying?
Well, there's a lot of white men out there. There's a fair number of white women as well. There are some folks of color, but it would seem if you only knew chefs from watching TV, that the only chefs that matter are European Americans.
Yeah, and this applies to so many things across the board. And when you think about respectability of careers and who deserves, you know, credit and awards and, you know, all the good stuff, it tends to be, I mean, as you get higher and higher in a career path, the demographics tend to kind of congeal, you know? So if you close your eyes and you imagine a chef, there's a very specific image that a lot of people will come up with.
As someone who has applied for jobs in the restaurant industry, been hired multiple times, what do you know about the process of, you know, a restaurant owner selecting a chef and how that contributes to this?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with networks. And I think this is very true across the board, no matter what industry you're in. And, you know, we say that the restaurant industry is one of the last meritocracies in the U.S., but it really isn't true. It is all about who you know and, you know, how you kind of use that information. And for me, it's just, you know, oftentimes I've worried that I was the diversity hire and, you know, used to make a restaurant or a group look good. And that's a real concern because they'll hire you, but they won't actually support you in the ways that you need to be supported in an industry that's often really racist and sexist and homophobic.
You say you worry that you're the diversity hire. There have been times when you've been hired, you've put some new dishes on the menu and then been told, hey, we're not trying to make this an Asian restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. They wanted me for the image and not really for what I was actually trying to make. And like my craft was just not part of the package to them. Hmm. It was a bit too much.
How do assumptions about food and its meaning just shape everyday interactions that you have as a Vietnamese American?
Well, let's see. So when I was younger, when I entered college, I think, 8 years ago, pho was just becoming a thing, which is a funny thing to say because it's been around in Vietnam and within Vietnamese communities for
decades. Very long time, right?
Yeah. A long time. It's like cereal for us. And so, because a lot of people eat it for breakfast. But when it was coming into vogue, I started hearing a lot of really interesting questions. Because before, I would tell people I was Vietnamese and they'd be like, where's that? What's that? And after a certain point, after I told people I was Vietnamese, they'd be like, oh, I love pho. Tell me about pho. It's like, where do you like to eat? And it's just like, it was a very stark change that I noticed almost immediately. I was like, wow, all of a sudden you're experts. Great.
So I totally get that that would be weird and annoying. On the other hand, I imagine that the people who say to you, I love pho, are telling you that, meaning I can relate to you because I like the food associated with your culture. Does their intention matter if they're being really, really ham-handed about it?
Well, I mean, I used to worry about individual intention, but now I kind of see it as sort of a symptom of the way we treat communities of color, the way we handle just talking about other countries that are not within the sort of Eurocentric world. It's really reductive. And, you know, the way people talk to me about it is just kind of an end product of that. You know, with Vietnam, it's just either the war or pho. And people don't want to talk to me about the war, so they're going to talk to me about pho. But there's a whole country there. There's so much there that we just don't have the time to really understand as Americans. And so we go to the shortcuts.
Yeah. I've even been thinking about the phrase ethnic food, which I try not to use anymore, but I'll confess I used for a long time. And then it occurred to me that, like, my traditional food of potatoes and cabbage is ethnic food, too. I just didn't think of it that way.
Right. When we talk about race, we often talk about, well, we don't include whiteness and we don't include Europeanness within that. And, you know, that's by design because whiteness is a default. So race is often an exceptional quality, you know, and it often indicates, you know, difference, problems, exotic kind of cultural markers.
Growing up, you experienced a sort of classic school cafeteria hazing about your lunch. What kinds of things did your parents pack for you that you realized would attract unwanted attention at school?
Well, way back, it was leftovers and from dinner. And I resisted really hard. And I was like, I want Lunchables or I want a sandwich. And the sandwiches that they sent along were like Braunschweiger on white bread with like butter and like pickles, mm-hmm. which is sort of like a bootleg bun me. So it was an attempt at a facsimile of a sandwich. But that was the frame of reference.
Yeah, and do you look back and think that your rebellion, I mean, do you feel bad about saying, I want something that's more like what my friends are eating?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it is funny to think that a lot of people who grew up similarly to me went through the same things because, you know, you're just reacting to what's around you. And especially because I grew up for a portion of my childhood in a very like homogenous area in kind of suburban rural Illinois. And so I didn't really have any support outside of my family for that kind of stuff.
When kids would say stuff about your lunch, did you take that in the moment to mean there's something strange about my family and about the place they come from?
Yeah, mainly it was just like, am I supposed to think this is gross? I guess I'm supposed to think this is gross. Because I, you know, a lot of school and that socialization is about calibrating what is socially acceptable.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would definitely recalibrated in that way, like, oh, okay, I'm not supposed to like this, or, you know, I'm not supposed to show this to anyone. And I have a lot of friends who had the same experiences, either, you know, with their school lunch or with inviting friends over to their homes and then asking their parents to not cook that night or whatever, just order pizza.
It is funny the way school files away some of those differences. This is not to equate my experience completely with yours, but like if my mom sent me with a hard-boiled egg, it was like a great lunch as far as I was concerned, but I realized very quickly that no one else thought it was okay. And somehow, whoever your peers are in elementary school, you just assume that they are much more knowledgeable about the way the world should work than your family.
Yeah, and it was so, that's why it was so funny to have people in my generation turn around and talk about how much they love pho when I entered college. I was like, wait, you guys are the same people, basically, who are like talking smack about my food. Okay.
So there are people who claim that to really know a culture, you have to eat its food. And that statement sounds unobjectionable at first, but you note that you've been eating Vietnamese food your whole life, and there are many things that you don't fully comprehend about Vietnamese culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to agree with that sentiment way back, but I realized you don't really learn everything unless you ask questions, mm-hmm. unless you talk to the people who made the food. Like, unless I began to have those hard conversations with my grandparents or with my parents about their experiences, I wouldn't know Jack.
Yeah, and I suppose there's the truth that you maybe can't fully understand a culture until you have done everything, including experiencing its food, but sitting down to a meal or 100 meals isn't going to tell you what you need to know.
Right. And I think this kind of folds into conversations about cultural appropriation in restaurants and chefs because, you know, we ask ourselves, I mean, I've been asked too a lot of questions about, okay, where's the line between appropriation and appreciation? And I will, you know, always tell people this, that it becomes appreciation when you can back it up with real relationships with the people of that culture. When you actually have asked people of that culture their opinions, their thoughts, their dreams, their perspectives.
Of course, most people wouldn't sit down somewhere and ask those questions. This requires really making an effort to be in communities where people may not be familiar.
Right. Because if you just stop at the food, I mean, you eat it and then you're done. What did you learn about the people? And yeah, it requires a lot of discomfort, perhaps, if you're not comfortable with talking with people who you might not know or you might not be familiar with, and you might be worried about committing a cultural faux pas. But, you know, for people of color in this country, we do it all the time. We have to necessarily deal with white people all the time. And so we're very adept at white people's culture.
My guest is writer Solejo. She's worked in the restaurant industry for more than a decade, and she's co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. We're having a conversation about appropriation and appreciation of different colors through cultures through the lens of food. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
So in Chinese, yolin, which literally means just oil pouring, you take a vegetable, you usually blanch it, lightly cook it, and then you use hot oil to bring out the fragrances of ginger, scallion, and other spices. And then you end up with a wonderful flavouring, which I hope you'll agree is completely dazzling and very surprising for a green vegetable. And what you want to heat the oil up hot enough that when you drip it onto those, you get a really aggressive sizzle. There. A bit of smoke is coming off that. Just a little bit of soy sauce, diluted with a bit of water, if you like, or not. A Chinese home-cooked meal will almost always have a simple green, stir-fried or blanched or in a soup.
Mm. You do know what you're doing. Not that I was dubious about that, but this is really good. I'm going to some more.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was British chef and writer Fuchsia Dunlop talking with Christopher Kimball. My guest this hour is writer Soleil Ho. She's worked in the restaurant industry for more than a decade. She co-hosts a podcast called The Racist Sandwich. We're talking about cooking food from other cultures, when it's appreciation and when it's appropriation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Soleil, I don't know how familiar you are with Fuchsia Dunlop. I do know that she is fluent in Mandarin and trained as a chef at the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine in Chengdu. What do you do with someone like her who wasn't born into this culture, perhaps, but has tried to understand it, at least from my perspective? And I will admit that my perspective is limited on her knowledge.
I love Fuchsia Dunlop, actually. And I actually have several of her books. So I think the key to understanding appropriation and its context is not leaving it up to individuals and not thinking about individuals and their whole life story and what's going on there, because I respect what she does. I think it's amazing. And, you know, she has serious cojones. But I think that it's really the whole apparatus that supports her and that puts her name on all of our lips when we think about Chinese food. Like, who is the expert on Chinese food? Oh, it's Fuchsia.
Right.
You know, it's not, you know, the centuries of Chinese chefs and cooks and practitioners who established that and who taught her. And to her credit, I think she names the people who've taught her, which I think is far and above what most chefs do when they cook food that is not of their culture. And so I really do think that it all adds up to sort of, okay, who is called upon in stories about Chinese food? You know, who did Christopher Kimball call to teach him about Chinese food?
Right.
It wasn't a Chinese person. It was Fuchsia.
Another thing that bothers you is when white chefs will claim to elevate or refine the dishes of other countries. Like, they started with something so good that I can make it perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it has so much to do with the civilizing impulse. You know, it might not be explicitly that, but it dates back to, you know, imperialism and colonialism and just sort of the idea that these brown people are savages and let's teach them to love Jesus Christ and clean them up, put them in, you know, nice clothes, and hopefully they will understand, you know, the glories of Western civilization. And it might seem like a stretch, but there's a lot of legacy to that. You know, we talk about, you know, holes in the walls and mom and pops, and there's a certain, like, class distinction when we talk about those things. They're very different from the elevated restaurants, you know, like the Jean-Georges Von Richten take on, you know, Indo-Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you expect to pay more. You value his labor more. You know, you expect to pay $16 for a fried rice from him as opposed to $5 from a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah, and there's an interesting reality that maybe someone cooking at a hole-in-the-wall restaurant is the best chef of a particular cuisine in an entire region, but because, you know, it's $8 for a meal instead of 68, we don't necessarily even consider them worthy of evaluation next to their peers.
Right. And there's sort of an assumption that those people, and, you know, when I say those people, I'm including myself, have natural talent for it. They didn't study. They didn't work for it. They're just home cooking, basically. And, you know, I think that holds a lot of, you know, judgment they're not elevating. The food is, you know, and the whole language of elevating is really interesting, right? Because elevation means you're bringing it up out of the muck, you know, out of this sort of like sensual, animalistic jungle kind of you know, cultural miasma.
We do have a weird thing in American culture where we seem to believe that a lot of talent is just innate, and we don't want to think very hard about how much work goes into being the best at whatever it is you do.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think that we grant certain types of people more flexibility and more adaptability. And, you know, we think that, for, you know, to use an analogy outside of food, we think Scarlett Johansson can play an Asian person or any flavor of ethnicity, but an Asian actress would not be granted the same amount of flexibility.
Hmm. All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Henri on the line in Dallas. Hello, Henri.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good, good. I'm very much enjoying the show, and I'm going to try and be as brief as possible. I'm a black man from Chicago. I lived 15 years in Utah, and I've lived about 3 years in Dallas. So I very much agree with many of the things that you've said, and you know, and I have my own ideas about, you know, white America taking things that brown or black people, whatever, you know, would do, and then, you know, quote unquote, refining them and making them different, things like dance and all other kinds of things. So I agree with very much many things you're saying and in the spirit in which you're saying them. There are a couple of things that I disagree with, and I'll just stick to one, though, and I wanted to hear what you thought about it. But the comment that you made about intent, and you seem to place little importance on intent, where to me, intent is almost supremely important. So if someone is coming to you, you know, with a genuine appreciation of what little they know about your culture, and they want to talk to you about it, and they want to, you know, get some type of communion with you, you know, over it, it would seem to be almost wrong to say that even though this person is coming to you with a pure and a, you know, and gentle intention, that you would place more importance on how you decide to take, you know, their communication versus the spirit in which they're intending it. To me, intent is far more important than how it is you choose to take something, negative or positive.
Well, thank you so much for your call, and Soleil, we'll have you respond.
Sure. So thank you, Henri. I guess to clarify what I was saying there is just, so I have a lot of friends of various cultures, you know, but I think that we're all capable of acting up in ways that reflect, you know, really messed up things about our society and what we've been taught by society and our upbringing. And so really what I was saying was, rather than judging intent, because it's really exhausting to think, okay, what's in this person's heart versus what's in that person's heart, I kind of coach my feelings of unease into thinking, okay, like, this is what they were told, and this is sort of a symptom of, you know, the narratives that we were fed about each other. So really, that's sort of a way for me to preserve my mental health in these sort of interactions.
How do you feel about the word authentic when applied to food? What makes any dish more or less authentic than any other version of it?
I stopped using that word. I really don't believe in it. I think because authentic calcifies our understanding of culture, and just culture is always changing. You know, there's people in, for to use an example, there's people in Japan who are making ramen with entirely wacky flavors, like coffee ramen and, you know,
wow,
turkey ramen and duck ramen. And, you know, it doesn't make it any less authentic because they're experimenting, because, you know, you forget that people have been working within their cultures and, like, working on their food and just, you know, all the time, constantly. It evolves. And so to say something is authentic, I think, is to put a lot of stock in this sort of, like, nostalgic idea of something that probably doesn't exist anymore.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also find us on Twitter at KERA Think. Let's speak now with Lisa in Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I just want to start off by saying this is such a fun topic. Kind of picking off of the question of authentic foods, I know we have a lot of chefs that go and take those cultural foods and do things of their own liking. But then what about the chefs of those cultures that are going and Americanizing their foods? And kind of what's the sentiment about going in the reverse direction where they're changing their culture's foods?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I can speak as the latter. So I think that as someone within a diaspora, you're always kind of negotiating your identity within like this one country, but also your ties to your family and your ancestry. And, you know, one of the ways we do it is just through our food and through our music and literature. So, I mean, it all is sort of a negotiation of like, who am I here? What flavors did I grow up with? And, you know, how do I reconcile myself with those? And, you know, I think that it's totally different because to think otherwise is to sort of flatten the dynamics here. Most of the time when you are of the latter camp, when you are adapting flavors to like the country that you're in the minority. And most of the time you're in a political minority as well. And, you know, there's really a question of scale too, because more often than not, entrepreneurs of color, chefs of color are given way fewer opportunities to even exercise that than the reverse in the U.S.
My guest is writer Soleil Ho. She's co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How would you adapt a recipe that you grew up with to an American palate so that you could sell whatever this dish is to the customers who come into the restaurant where you're cooking?
You know, I actually don't do that anymore.
You don't?
Mm-hmm. No. I've since given up trying to appease this big other mainstream, Main Street American that, you know, I was afraid of for so long in my life. You know, I used to always ask myself, like, does this have too much fish sauce? Is this too spicy? Is this, you know, too whatever? But I realized that question was an extension of asking if I'm too much. For mainstream culture. Am I being too real here? And it's a lot healthier to stop asking.
I've had the experience as a white person of going into certain restaurants and ordering something and then having the person say, you're not going to like that. And, I, you know, it doesn't bother me because I get it. They've had people return dishes before. But it makes you wonder, like, if we walk into a restaurant that doesn't serve a cuisine that is familiar to us, it's kind of on us to try to enjoy what we've been served.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ostensibly you're going for a new experience and to appreciate the culture. So that also means appreciating things that might not make you comfortable or might frighten you or might just be too much. And there's risk in that. And I think with discomfort, we learn so much more.
How does food photography, as practiced by Instagram and fancy food magazines, how does that contribute to the way we process the idea of food that we consider to be of other cultures as opposed to food that we consider to be sort of American or typical?
So this kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier about race being a signifier of otherness and whiteness just being kind of in the background, and it doesn't really count as race because it's white. So with food photography, and I think a lot of visual media as well, it's all about shortcuts, right? You want to send a message very quickly. So a lot of people who are, you know, who are looking for those shortcuts will use racial signifiers when they take photos of food or, you know, fashion. For example, I've seen this a lot for Chinese recipes in a magazine or a spread. They'll take the photo of the food and they'll use, oh God, there's these awful salt shakers that have like the conical hats and the slanted eyes. And I've seen so many
of
those
in
photographs, for example.
I think of those as like really garage sale items. That's funny that they're in a magazine or something.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, and then you have, you know, the sort of patterns that signify, you know, Mexican culture or Nigerian culture that are used in these photographs. But on the other hand, if you have, I don't know, like an egg salad sandwich, something that's very like iconic and American, it's just on a table. There's no gimmick. There are no, like,
there's only so much you can do with egg salad, I guess. But yeah, I know what you mean. I want to talk a little bit about political correctness in all of this, because it's occurred to me, thinking about the things that your podcast and the things that I've read that you've written, I was thinking about resistance to political correctness, which sort of, you know, it waxes and wanes over time. But in some ways, it seems like people who say political correctness shouldn't exist often are people who belong to the dominant culture that are not willing to code switch in the way we expect people from minority aspects of the culture to code switch all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to take those critiques seriously, I admit, just because, you know, if you don't really know how it feels, and how would you know it doesn't, you know, it doesn't exist? Or just like when you talk about cultural appropriation, class privilege and white privilege or whatever. So, yeah, like it's not really about being PC, you know, because PC has so many like negative connotations. It's about politics. It's cynical. But really what we at the podcast really want to emphasize is have relationships with people who are not like you. That's all we're asking. Think more about what you're doing.
Is that easier, do you think, for people of your generation than it is for folks born in the 50s, 60s, earlier than you?
I don't know. I mean, I think people of color have been here from the beginning.
That's a fair point. My guest is writer Solejo. She's worked in the restaurant industry for a long time. She is also co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. We're talking about cooking and eating food from other cultures, when it's appreciation and when it's appropriation. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send us a tweet. We are at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
So if you're like me and you think that a bite of those crispy, moist, incredibly melt in your mouth carnitas is the ultimate pork experience, well, I've got some good news for you. You don't have to go to Mexico. You don't have to buy one of those great big copper cauldrons. We don't have to wait for Sunday, because I've developed what I think is the absolute simplest but very satisfying carnitas recipe. Just go to the butcher and buy a bone-in pork shoulder roast.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boy. That was Rick Bayless, host of the PBS show Mexico, One Plate at a Time. We're talking this hour about cultural appropriation and appreciation when it comes to food from other cultures with writer and chef Solejo, who is co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. All right, Soleil, thoughts on Rick Bayless?
I was holding this back the whole time.
All right, so why does Rick Bayless make you laugh?
Oh, such a corny dude. Oh, Rick. All right, so my main takeaway from Rick Bayless, who, you know, I grew up watching his show in Chicago, was he was recently, well, not recently, in the past year on The Sporkful, which is this great podcast about food, and they did a series on race and cooking other people's food. So appropriation and sharing and all of that stuff, and they interviewed him and they asked him, does your white privilege play into the fact that you are the voice of Mexican cuisine in the U.S. right now? And he said no. And so I'll always remember that. He just didn't even consider that that might be a factor. Hmm. But, you know, I think we're so much more willing to trust certain voices and invest, you know, invest ourselves and money into certain people like Rick Bayless based on, you know, all sorts of things that we were sort of programmed to think about, who is capable of making good food and who can we trust to teach us in a way that is accessible to us. You know, I'm not saying that he is talentless or anything like that, or he doesn't deserve anything that he gets, but I do think that we are, as a society, are more willing to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, let me ask you this about the difference between, like, cooking something to sell or to build a reputation on or to win an award for versus cooking at home. Because, I mean, if I were limited to cooking what I grew up on, it would be boxed macaroni and cheese and potato flakes out of a box. I did not come from a foodie family. Like, is it okay to experiment, you know, get cookbooks from all over and try to make those at home?
Absolutely. I think there's a world of a difference between those two things. Cooking at home is, you know, it's a beautiful thing. More people should do it. And, you know, I think that there's only so much that you affect as a home cook. You know, your sphere of influence is pretty small.
Yes.
You know, yes. You can satisfy yourself and your family and your friends, and that's an amazing and gorgeous thing. And really, in that case, I would just ask that home cooks who want to learn more about other cultures and learn how to cook that food, maybe, you know, consider who's on your bookshelf and consider, you know, the blogs that you might have bookmarked and see if you can diversify, if you could stand to diversify. Because there's amazing authors and, you know, food writers within so many different cultures who maybe don't get enough exposure because we're so used to looking at the same names. Like, you know, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have Rick Bayless cookbooks on their shelves. Do you have any Mexican authors that you could trust too? So there's that. And then I guess the difference between that and profiting off of the food is huge, because the question of who profits off of culture is colored by so many historical things. It's upheld by just decades and decades of unequal sort of trust given to people of color in the U.S., in terms of investment, you know, business loans, who's able to open these establishments in the places where they live. So, you know, there's this whole thing where if you are a white chef and you are going to open, for example, a Southern food restaurant in a place that's gentrifying in a historically Black neighborhood, maybe stop and think about, okay, is there anyone else from this neighborhood who has tried this and failed based on, you know, various factors like race and maybe their projected inability to attract as many investors as I can, things like that. And then consider, okay, where's the money going? Are only white people profiting off of this? And see if there are any ways you can disrupt that.
All right, I want to go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Peter is calling from Houston. Hi, Peter.
Hi, this is Peter.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, I wonder if your guest has considered, in terms of appropriation, that different cultures have different needs in regards to appropriating. That some cultures have a great deal to offer in regards to their food, whereas some cultures don't have much to offer. I'm thinking in particular that, for example, as you can probably guess, I originally come from Britain. We have notoriously bad food. We may have a lot to offer in terms of music, but not a lot to offer in terms of food. They have more of a need to appropriate than some other cultures do.
That's a really interesting perspective. What do you think, Sally?
Man, I mean, I don't know if that justifies colonialism, though.
I'm not sure that he was justifying colonialism, but
no,
appropriation.
I'm joking. But I do think that, you know, I don't think you necessarily have to appropriate in order to try new food or, like, incorporate different flavors into your repertoire. You know, it doesn't have to be innately exploitative. And when I talk about appropriation, that's what I mean. I mean that you are profiting off of, you know, food that is outside of your culture and consolidating the wealth within your own culture and not sharing that part of the relationship. So that doesn't necessarily have to be the relationship. You know, I think I guess I can't speak to the lack of flavor in my own personal culture, though.
Can you talk about the how food writers avoid or fall into traps when describing cuisine from other cultures?
Oh, yes. So I keep tabs on a lot of food writing establishments. I love reading about what people are saying about restaurants and food. And, you know, oftentimes this is changing. You know, I think that this is not the prevailing trend now, but when I started, you know, 8 years ago, I saw a lot of the same kind of language that you read in travel writing, or you used to read in travel writing, where they would talk about, you know, unironically, the Orient or the Far East, or just saying exotic. You know, if you want burgers with an exotic flair, go to so-and-so place. Hmm. Or they talk about, you know, it's just the way that they kind of couch their descriptions are so mired in this historical kind of Orientalism, at least when you talk about Asian cuisine. And, you know, even to this day, like, we have a lot of coverage of places that are, I think, appropriative. And, you know, there's just not a lot of questioning of the language that surrounds it. And, you know, for example, I guess there was a place in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, that opened, I think, within the past year, called Summer Hill. And they, in their press releases and in their interviews about the bar, they used a lot of really objectifying language about the neighborhood that they were in. And they were gentrifying in this historically Black neighborhood in New York City. And, you know, a lot of the media establishments didn't really talk about that, or they didn't concern themselves with that, because I think, you know, a lot of food writers think, we're just here to talk about the food. We don't want to talk about politics. But so much of food is so inextricably linked to politics. You can't avoid it. And avoiding it is political. And luckily, we've had a lot of, you know, thanks to Twitter, and I think thanks to the work of Eater, especially, they called this out and they were like, okay, you can't talk about your neighbors like this. This is not cool. But for so long, that sort of critique and that sort of clapback just wasn't there.
My guest is Soleil Ho. She's a writer who has worked in the restaurant industry in a variety of positions, all the way up to executive chef. She's co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. We're talking this hour about cooking food from other cultures, when it is appreciation and when it's appropriation. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have an email here from Joe, who writes, as a Black man, I often wish that the foods I grew up eating hadn't been adopted by popular culture, with the consequence of making those foods extremely expensive when they were once very cheap. Things like pork ribs, collard greens, chicken wings, oxtails, which were poor people's food, are all but unaffordable to the poor today. When I was a child, these were the things that genteel people threw away.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I've watched this happen with oxtail as well. And I think it was 2013, the writer Mickey Kendall, who is this writer based in Chicago, pointed out this Whole Foods campaign that had just launched, which the tagline was, collards are the new kale. And she was just, she met it with so much dread, because she was like, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to afford collards for my family anymore. And, you know, that whole thing is just, when you can see the relationship between kind of trendiness and price gouging, it's just really disturbing, because then what's there left to eat? And it's the same thing happened to kale too, actually. So, yeah, I think it's really fascinating how people of color and like the cultures that they build just through, you know, especially when it comes to Southern food, through just the legacy of slavery and having to make do with scraps and thrift, and having that history kind of stripped away in favor of just the food in itself and the trendiness of that food, it's really, it gets me. It's awful.
Is there something more personal or different about food than about other art forms or crafts? I was thinking about, and I realize that we're talking about a minority person interpreting a majority culture, and that's different than the other way around. But the filmmaker Ang Lee, right, was born in Taiwan. Nobody would argue that he wasn't perfect to direct Brokeback Mountain, The Ice Storm, Sense and Sensibility. Is there something that makes food different in terms of someone coming in and saying, I understand this culture well enough to recreate its food and present it to you, even though it's not my culture?
You know, I think for a lot of people, food is the way that they understand themselves. And, you know, it's funny. You can avoid living your life like watching movies or listening to music or looking at art, even though that sounds like an awful existence. But you can't avoid eating food. Hmm. And it's something that you grapple with every day, like from your choices to of like what to eat for lunch or even like, you know, oh, what's grandma making today? So, yeah, I think the Ang Lee example doesn't really fit to me because, you know, I think especially in this iteration of the planet Earth that we live in today, so many of us are taught and trained from a young age to understand American culture and understand like Western culture. So we're all very fluent in it. You know, you brought up code switching earlier. I think that's absolutely the thing that it happens a lot.
What is the best way to ask about something we don't understand if it's served to us at a friend's house or at a restaurant?
I guess I can say, I mean, you just ask what it is. That's mm-hmm. That seems simple enough. Or just ask, you know, where does this come from? Or how did you make this? The worst way to do it is just like, what is this? You know?
Right.
I had a friend who brought a pig's head. Actually, she's Filipina, and she brought a pig's head to a potluck. And someone reacted by puking in the sink. That's not the way to react.
That will ruin please. Any party anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But
you, so, yeah, faux pas.
Notice that there are times when you sit down in a restaurant and you catch, like, people, white people, I guess, looking over their shoulders like, oh, let me see how this girl eats this food, and then I'll know what to do.
Yeah, and actually when I was a teen, I used to screw it up by doing the most backwards things with my food. I would use chopsticks as knives and just like stick them in like all kinds of things if I felt like someone was watching, and I would hear them like, what is she doing? Just to throw them off the trail, you know.
Did you ever see anyone like copying you? Well, this must be the right way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think that's the thing, right? Like these people are looking and they're not actually asking me. They're just kind of mm-hmm. eavesdropping in a way. And I think I've had so many amazing and beautiful collaborations with chefs that I've worked with where I taught them something about the food that I grew up with and the weird little like shortcuts that my family came up with. And, you know, they genuinely want to learn and they ask me questions. They have a relationship with me. And I think that is just what we should all aim for.
Writer Solejo has worked in the restaurant industry in a number of capacities. She's been a dishwasher, a server, an executive chef. She's co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. Soleil, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and on Twitter. The Twitter handle is at KERAThink. You can find the podcast and learn more about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.